The following content has been provided by the University of Erlangen-Nürnberg.
So why am I here? My background is in geography, and I developed that into development studies, took that into development studies many years ago, and I wrote my first paper on disasters in 1976, to which you're all supposed to go, "Oh, how is that possible? You're not that old." So I was about 10 at the time. And that was written in India during not a very serious flood, but what I noticed was that in the Ganges plain, where I was doing quite a lot of my field work, the villages, many of them, are on a sort of a mound. And the richer people and the higher castes live in the middle, and the outcasts and the poorer people live around the edge. So, of course, the poorer people get flooded first. So it's my first kind of concrete example of social differentiation leading to different outcomes for different social groups in a disaster or in a relatively minor flood. I was then in Patna, which is the main city of the state of Bihar, and discovered, quite interestingly, that the British had instituted flood protection measures for the city in the form of what they called a ringbund. A bund is a word for a wall to protect, and a ringbund is one that surrounded the city to keep the floodwaters of the Ganges out. But of course, keeping the water out of the city meant that the water had to go somewhere else. So this was quite an interesting way in which we still have this problem today of flood defences may be all right for some people, but they transfer the risk to others. So I had a very interesting time, and I wrote that article, which never became famous, almost exactly the same time as O'Keefe, Ken and Ben wrote this one, which is down here at the front, which is a sort of an archaeological excavation to get this up, which is called Taking the Naturalness Out of Natural Disasters. And this was part of the process that several of the people in this room were involved in, which was to take the idea that disasters were at all natural and undermine that and unpack it and insist that disasters are socially constructed. And that has been the process that has gone basically in the last 30 years. It still hasn't succeeded completely, as I'll show in a minute, but basically the argument has shifted quite fundamentally during that period of time, certainly in academia, and certainly in some of the organisations that deal with development and disasters, has shifted away from the idea of their naturalness towards the idea of their being socially constructed. And that has been a major achievement, really, in that process. So we'll be coming back to that, and I'll say a bit more about that. So my background is in geography. I then studied economics and politics, and my work in relation to disasters, because I've done a lot of other work on India and China as well, has focused on how do we explain the vulnerability of people? What is it about society, economics, politics, and culture later, which explains why some people suffer more in disasters than others? And that has been really the driving force for my work. But within that, I really am not all that interested in disasters. And that might sound rather strange. The reason for that is relatively few people die in disasters as compared with other problems of everyday life. So I think I mentioned yesterday that until relatively recently, each year, more children died under the age of five of five preventable diseases than died in the entire 20th century from sudden onset disasters. So part of writing at risk was to question why are so many people interested in disasters? Of course, they grab our attention, they grab the headlines in the news and the media, and we have an emotional response to them. An emotional response which is actually so significant, as I was talking to some people last night over dinner, that after the Japanese disaster 2 years ago, people were collecting money for it. Why? To give money to one of the richest countries in the world. But our emotional response, and this is where we come into our behaviours and cultures, our emotional response take over from rationality in our thinking about how disasters affect us and other people. And so really the book At Risk, which Perdita kindly referred to, is actually a book about why disasters are not important. And it's really saying that you should only understand disasters in the context of development, the problems of everyday life which need to be fulfilled before people will take disaster risk seriously. And so my talk really is about now what we need to be doing in disaster research and disaster practice, which brings fully into play other factors which the disaster industry, in my view, does not take seriously. And that's also why we're here at this conference. So that's a bit of background mixed up with the discourse that I'm planning to use. To look at this again, a simplified history of concepts. So before the 1970s, we could say that most explanations of disaster were what you could call naturalist or physicalist explanations. They focused on nature as the way in which we would explain what is happening in an event. And this was then challenged from the mid-1970s. Another key book was the one by Anders Weichmann and Lloyd Timberlake, Disasters, Acts of God or Acts of Man, around this idea. And these people were from development studies. We were all looking at third world countries, as they were called then, thinking, what is going on here with disasters? So then in comes the equation, disasters is hazards times vulnerability. And we're beginning to think about this connection between vulnerability and hazards. In the 1990s, a bit of guilt comes in, a bit of political correctness comes in, and quite understandably, people start saying, well, the term vulnerability makes people appear to be victims all the time, and we don't want that. I don't use the term vulnerability in that sense. I think it should be a scientific term, as I will explain. But people started saying, well, people have got capacities as well, and of course they have. And so we can put this into the equation, and usually the equation is seen by this, where there is a reciprocal relationship between vulnerability and capacity. In other words, you increase capacity and it reduces vulnerability, blah, blah, blah. And I'm absolutely quite happy with that. We then get into the 2000s, which is after the International Decade of Natural Disaster Risk Reduction, which was the UN decade of the 1990s. Notice that even the UN in the 1990s called them natural disasters. United Nations Decade of Natural Disaster Reduction. Hardly anyone's ever heard of it. In that area, we get the additional concept of exposure being a different concept from vulnerability, related to it, but needing to be looked at. And I'll come back to that, but I won't spend too much time on that. We're now into the 2010s, and this is where we bring in the idea of culture. But as you see, I've also put in the dreaded word resilience there, which I won't have time to talk about, except perhaps as a footnote. But here we are, and I've added culture to this equation. So that we're looking at what is it about culture that is relevant to us understanding the conditions which establish the disaster problem. And I think it has been neglected, and we neglected it in the book At Risk as well. So this, I think, is, for me, a quite interesting way of looking at the change over the last 40 years during this process by which we are struggling with the explanation of disasters in the social, economic, political context with now culture added in. For me, doing this is partly a self-criticism of what we did in At Risk. I think there's an awful lot that's wrong with the book At Risk. I would love to do a new edition. I don't know if that will happen, but and in particular, the book had a purpose, and that purpose was to establish the idea that disasters were socially constructed and that economic, political, and social systems differentiated between different groups of people. Not only rich and poor, but there were processes by which different groups of people were more or less affected by hazards, and that was the key purpose of it. But shaking out of that book, there was a dominant kind of discourse or approach in it which was suggesting that poverty was a key factor and that poor people were forced to live in dangerous places. Their poverty, in other words, was a major factor affecting how they were exposed to hazard risks. And I think that what we failed to do was to understand what I now call innocent disasters. I got a lot of criticism for it, including from one of the co-authors of the book, which I'm not worried about that. What I'm concerned about is that we actually initiate debate on this. And I'll talk about this. What I mean by innocent disasters, and some of you read the paper, is that actually many people live deliberately in dangerous places. And we actually have to take this on board and understand what is it that they're doing by doing so. What is it that they're... How are they balancing that process? And in part, what I'm doing and what I think we're doing in this conference is a critique of a lot, not all, but a lot of DRR work done at the higher levels by institutions that, in my view, fails to take account of culture and perception of risk. So my talk is going to be trying to summarise some of those arguments. And I think the problem arises because most DRR work by institutions, academics, NGOs and so on, is focused on a very narrow type of rationality, and that it assumes that everyone else shares that view of rationality. It's a post-Enlightenment view, a scientistic view of the world, and that we need to overcome this in order to understand how real people behave in the reality of their emotional and cultural attitudes towards risk. And I think that we have to get this right, because with climate change, the problems are going to get worse. And so it is really incumbent on us very quickly, if we think we're doing it wrong, to change it to get it right because of the increased risks and vulnerability that will come from climate change. Now, I've put culture in quotes in this talk, and that's because it isn't only about culture. And it will get messy. And I would also say that I'm not an expert in any of these areas. What I am is someone who has worked in my area, now realising that we need to take in much more psychology, behavioural economics, sociology, and anthropology. These are disciplines which are missing, by and large missing, from most disaster risk reduction agencies. And when we talk about what we see, I think you will realise that the fact that they are missing is quite extraordinary. And it is quite extraordinary because in other areas of human endeavour where we look at risk and people's attitudes to risk, for example, in health, there is a huge overlap in work on health with ideas of psychology and behavioural aspects and cultural aspects of how health is dealt with, which has not penetrated into disaster risk reduction work. And so I think we've got a lot of learning to do, and I'm not presenting myself here as an expert in these areas. Yesterday, some people said, we should actually understand what we mean by disasters. This is my definition of a disaster. A disaster is something that causes death, usually, injury, illness, hunger, loss of assets, livelihood loss and disruption, social and mental dislocation. Now, this is scale neutral. This could be one family or one individual. It's a disaster for them that somebody dies. Okay? So what we're interested in is higher scale disasters which affect a large number of people. So that's what DRR is doing. It is doing this at a scale where it is affected by these natural hazards. That's the area that we're generally in. And having moved from the physicalist or naturalist explanation of disasters, we now know that the hazard is just the trigger for the disaster, for the deaths, for the injury, and so on. And what we really need to understand is the vulnerability. And it's understanding the vulnerability that helps us to understand why does a hazard get translated into an actual disaster. And I'll come back to these five components, and you'll see that these are very different from the crunch model that we have in the book. I've revised over the last 10 years, revised and I hope improved the crunch model, the pressure and release model, into something which I think is more rigorous. And it's more rigorous and therefore has a more scientific validity in terms of understanding. And these five components, which I've written about elsewhere, I can send you the reference if you like, because I won't have a great deal of time to go into them. In my view, and this is a people-centred view of disasters, this is a people-centred, we're not looking at buildings, we're not looking at bridges, we're not looking at schools, we're looking at people. And we're moving beyond people into understanding what it is that is causing their vulnerability. And we need to know what are the causal factors in creating this vulnerability. And in the, for example, we need to know what is the household and its livelihood and how damaged it would be by different types of hazards. And note that a flood has a different effect than an earthquake, and we need to understand the vulnerability in context of the different types of hazards. And we know there's a causal relationship between your livelihood and your baseline status. Your baseline status basically being the health, nutritional status that you have, and that this is by and large an income determined relationship. And we also know that your income enables you to protect yourself and your household from hazards that you know about. And so this is represented here by a solid house. You live in a safe house in a safe place. But that is determined not by income, but it's also determined by culture, behaviour and perception of risk. So that house is often broken and often in a not safe place, and people therefore rely on what I call social protection, which comes from an outside organisation or agency, extended family, NGO, Red Cross, government, whatever. And that social protection itself is determined, the quality of it is determined by power relationships, by governance systems, by the way in which the social protection is or is not fostered by that wider governance. A classic example, just to give you a quick example, is Amartya Sen's comments 15 years ago now on famine, that in India it's extremely difficult to have a wide, large-scale famine because the governance system allows a relatively free press, which is down there investigating it as soon as news of possible mass hunger emerges. Whereas by contrast, China, with no free media, covers up disasters, conceals them, and arrests people who mention them. So this is a very simplistic example of how the governance system can affect the degree of social protection. Another would be whether or not building regulations are implemented properly. So we have these five characteristics of vulnerability which are interrelated, and governance power also, of course, affects livelihoods. There's a very powerful connection there with livelihoods because governance, and we're back now to Ken's topics yesterday, we're back to the systems. What are the systems that distribute and enable people to have access to different assets? How do they get access to land to grow? And I'll come back to this again later on. So we have this connection between these different characteristics of vulnerability, and I've thought long and hard about them, and I think that actually if we focus on these five characteristics and understand the causes of why they are high or low, we will be getting quite a lot of progress into understanding how hazards have their effects. But of course, we need to understand the causal links. So this is a revised version of the crunch model, the causal links that take us back from this blue box back into the root causes. And I structure this by looking at the power systems. The social framing of vulnerability is caused by the standard power systems of class, gender, ethnicity, caste, and other power relationships, which can include culture, cultural relationships, and that these themselves are, of course, embedded in the root causes, which involve power relations, demographics, conflict, environment, debt crises, and so on. And actually, Ian Davis uses a version of this diagram with students. We could do it, but we haven't got time, in which you take a particular disaster and you work backwards to the root causes of what was going on. And people have done quite interesting stuff on this for the Haiti earthquake, where they've traced back to the debt crisis. I had no idea until I read about the Haiti earthquake that Haiti was paying reparations to France for the slave being freed until 1947. In the revolution that led to Haiti becoming independent from France in 1814, around then, as a result of that, France insisted on the country paying them compensation to the slave owners, which was going on until 1947. There were other debt problems. There was also the United States offloading cheap rice, undermining the rural economy, blah, blah, blah. So you can actually take disasters and you can trace them back to root causes in quite interesting ways. I want to do this now for climate change, and where climate change fits into the crunch model is, in my view, in three ways. First is the obvious one, that climate change makes some of the hazards worse, either through making them more frequent or more intense. No time to go into that in detail, but this is the most obvious area. In DRR, this is the thing that people are concerned about. What is less concerned about, which I think is really, really important, is that climate change is going to increase the number of poor people because it will undermine their livelihoods. So there will be more vulnerable people because of the effect of declining agricultural output, damaged livelihoods from the effect of climate change on their assets and on their livelihoods. And then there's a third factor, in that increasing poverty is also often a factor, not always, but often a factor, which damages the environment because poor people are forced to mine or damage the environment for their survival, cutting trees, making charcoal, overfishing, blah, blah, blah. So it seems to me there are three ways in which we can incorporate into the crunch model the effects of climate change. Now, how I want to structure the rest of the talk is actually to look at four myths. And these are deliberately controversial to get you thinking, to get you responding to this. And the first myth, I'm not going to have much time to do two of them, but the other two overlap considerably with our subject matter of culture and behaviour, risk behaviour. So I will focus on those. The first is that people in their communities, and I'll explain why that's in quotes in a minute, are interested in disaster risk reduction. There's very, very little evidence that people, when you get down to the locations, the grassroots, the so-called communities, that people are at all concerned about what we worry about. Many people do not give priority to the risks of disasters, even when they face significant risks that they have already experienced or that have been predicted. And if we don't take this on board, we are not going to devise good policies. How on earth can you devise a good policy for people who don't take seriously what you want to do? So that's the first thing. We know this, so why is this not being done in disaster risk reduction? There is a lack of rationality in the disaster managers. The institutions that do it are not behaving rationally because they are ignoring this key empirical fact. So what are the barriers to learning? Why are we not learning this? Why is it being played down? We need to look at this and what should be done to change it. And that's partly why we're here. We know that people live voluntarily in dangerous places because they give them livelihoods. Volcanic soils are often very fertile. Floods bring soil fertility and fish. People in Bangladesh often don't worry about floods. In Bengali, there are two words for floods, or at least two words. One is good flood and the other is bad flood. And most of the time, people benefit from floods and they don't want floods to be stopped. In fact, some people will say, if there's no flood, that's a disaster. And it's outsiders who perceive flood as a disaster and as a problem. You had the same around the world. We had the example of Mozambique yesterday. It's happened in Colombia, which regularly has flood disasters in a floodplain. What do you expect in a floodplain? You expect floods. If you live there and put stuff there, of course it's going to be flooded. So anyway, coasts, water supplies and fault zones. And we're not talking about poor, ignorant, irrational people in third world countries. We're talking about Florida, California and the Netherlands. And you know, there is no shortage of people going to live in Florida or California, despite the well-known risks. So people will take risks in where they are known. And the reason they do it is because they trade off the risk to benefit from the livelihoods or the other benefits that they get from those dangerous places. And I think it's quite interesting to think about the economist's concept of discount. You discount to the future, so you discount the risk into the future for the current benefits. And it would be very interesting to do an economistic kind of investigation of that. Attitudes to risks and perceptions of risks are not in the rational box that outsiders and experts love to use. We have to step outside our box of what we expect people will be doing to behave in the way we want them to. And in this, cultural factors are crucial, behavioural factors in the face of risks, and the idea that people have different rationalities, and we have to accept that people do not have the rationalities that we want them to have in order to make our management of risk easy and convenient. What's the empirical evidence? Well, all over the world, thousands of assessments have been done at community level, versions of VCA vulnerability and capacity assessment done by NGOs and Red Cross. In hardly any of these do the people in these participatory methods mention the risks that the outsiders go to talk about. Nevertheless, the NGOs very often end up trying to do the earthquake risk or the flood risk or the hurricane risk, despite the fact that the people are telling them that that's not what bothers them. What bothers them is usually water supply, illness, poverty, crime, transport accidents. And Yemen is a good point for that one. In about 2004, the Red Crescent in Yemen went to two flood areas to try to find out, could they do something to help community-based flood preparedness? And they did their VCAs, they did their participatory talks, and after 6 months, they came away with a road safety program. And that's because that's what people gave priority to. And if you look at the CRED database on Yemen, for that period, more people died on the roads than in floods. And so, in a sense, the people had it right. But what happens when the NGO or the outside agency, or it's a DIPECO project, where you go and you insist that you're going to do it on floods or hurricanes or earthquakes? And that is not good because it won't last. It won't have sense. The Sundarbans I'll come to in a minute. So I think there are two aspects that we need to be looking at. The first is that people do not have the same risk hierarchy that DRR agencies do. They have an entirely different set of understandings of what risks they are facing. And they do not have give priority to what we do. And then the culture, in quote marks again, and behaviours towards risk, the significant aspects of culture lead people to have attitudes to risk that appear to be illogical or irrational and do not fit into the logical approach of outside agencies. And I think that's what we've missed, and we've missed these two things. We have to address them pretty quickly and seriously. The Sundarbans example, I think, is wonderful. It's an extreme case. This is the Sundarbans, the largest mangrove forest in the world, on the delta of the Brahmaputra and Ganges. It spreads across Bangladesh and India. It looks like this. If you go down a narrow creek, I won't mention that because that will spoil the next slide. This is where we are in this part of the world. And what's interesting is that some students I taught in Copenhagen University a few years ago, they went on a field visit to this area in 2010. This was just after two cyclones. There was Cyclone Isla in 2009, which had just happened, and another one, Cyclone Sidr, in 2007. And they asked the people, they did a focus group discussion or some blah blah, what are the problems you face? They said, water is becoming too salty, we get attacked by pirates, and we risk being eaten by tigers. And they did not mention cyclones. Okay? Now, of course, that doesn't mean they're not worried about cyclones. And one of the interesting things about people's behaviour that was mentioned yesterday is that people change their attitude to risk according to what they think is possible. So if they don't think it's actually possible to do very much about cyclones or floods or earthquakes, they won't talk about it because they culturally or psychologically, it's not possible to do anything, so why on earth worry about it? Okay, and that's where an explanation comes in. It's in God's hands, for example, a kind of a religious, and this goes back to ancient times, but I think this is where we're trying to do something about it. We have to take into account people's own priorities. So people have a risk hierarchy. At the top of this are infrequent and severe risks, represented by not very many at the top. At the bottom are the much more frequent risks. And people have this risk hierarchy. At the top, little we can do about them, in the hands of God, blah, blah, blah. At the bottom, they're common and coped with. We live with floods. We don't mind floods. We can manage with them. But none of these will be mentioned by people. When you ask people what are the risks they face, their priorities are down here with everyday life. Putting food on the plate next week, paying school fees, being able to buy medicine, and so on. And it's this that we're missing, because the DRR agencies are in the top part of this triangle, and people are in the bottom yellow part of the triangle. And we have to somehow... And now you can see why you cannot understand disasters without understanding them in the context of development. Because unless you solve people's development problems first, people will not take the bigger risks seriously. And that is the key finding that we should be having. And therefore, to have disaster risk reduction agencies which are separate from development agencies is completely crazy. Because it means institutionally they are not going to be in the right place or doing the right thing. So they have to be much more integrated, and we have to stop seeing disaster risk reduction as being separate. And with climate change, the DRR people are now taking over extreme risk, and you can see the problems that might arise. I love this quote. It's from a Chekhov play. So we have a mix of people. Some live in dangerous places because they have less choice. On the left-hand side, because of economic and political determinants, poverty, discrimination, and so on. On the right, they have more choice. And there's a kind of a spectrum. And it's mixed. But the point that I want to make is that many people live voluntarily in dangerous places. And if we have policies that try to move people to safer places, they will fail. Because people want access to the dangerous place for their livelihoods, and they discount the risk into the future, or they minimize the risk. They tell themselves stories that minimize the significance of the risk, and that's where also culture comes in. Myth number two, community is where it's at and where we should work. Community, and as in, for example, community-based adaptation and community-based disaster risk reduction, I would go so far as to say there is no such thing as community. It's an invention by outsiders for our own convenience to enable us to work in locations. And that's because we have to do projects. And if you do a project, it has to be in a place. And usually a place is a geographically defined place which has a boundary, which means that it's a village or sometimes a region or a neighborhood if it's in a city. But within that place, which we then call a community because we want it to be warm, cuddly, and fluffy, and people to be helping each other. How do we define it? It has huge internal divisions based around gender, class, ethnicity, caste, religion, age group. And we behave as if people will get on with each other, and we can therefore do disaster risk reduction, and everyone will be warm and cuddly and help each other, and it will be fine. It's rubbish. Okay, my first field work in India, I was taken by an Indian friend to his village, and he said, oh, the head of the village has seen us, I'll have to introduce you. My friend spoke perfect English, the head of the village did not, so he's translating. And as I'm leaving, I'm shaking hands with the head of the village to say, thank you for showing me around and so on. And my friend is saying into my ear, by the way, the reason he's the head of the village is because he's got most land, he's the richest, most powerful person. Last year, his workers on the land, the wage labourers, protested about the low wages he was paying, and he had the two leaders killed. I shake hands, smile even more, and get out of there as quickly as possible. So here I am shaking hands with a murderer. The police have done nothing. This is power in the countryside in much of the world. We all know this. Every single NGO that works in developing countries knows this. And yet we all pretend that there is a conducive framework at the community level which will enable us to do disaster risk reduction. And it's complete rubbish. And now with climate change, what we're finding is that there is a situation in which community is being used as the entry point for doing adaptation. And yet if you went to most of South Asia, between 25 and 60% of the population in a South Asian village are landless. Nobody has got a clue what adaptation means for a landless family. They are lumped in with the community, and it's hoped that if you have community-based adaptation, somehow that will solve the adaptation needs of the landless. Trust me, it won't, because they are subject to the power relationships within that village, of the landlord, of the caste system, of the ethnic tensions which are going on. So we're now getting to a situation where we have a complete myth being constructed around adaptation at the grassroots, which will fail unless we start taking these issues seriously. And so we use the concept of community for our sake, because it's convenient for us, because it enables us to pretend we are working for poor people at the grassroots level. And it makes it possible for us to spend budgets which have a boundary around them, a physical boundary as well as a conceptual boundary. And community is a concept that fits with what we want to do and not with how people experience their own lives. And I think this, I can't talk about that more, but I can see I'll get quite a lot of feedback on that, which is good because I want you to think about it. So community is where we're working, not a real thing. Myth number three, and we're back now to Ken's area yesterday, governments care about their people and want to reduce disasters and implement policies that improve resilience. Complete bollocks in many cases. And I'm not talking about Bangladesh or India or Zimbabwe. I'm talking about the United States. Okay? So we're not talking about, you know, flea-bitten bad countries with bad leaders in those parts of the poor world. We're talking about what goes on in rich countries as well. And I think we really need to take this into account. The problem is that many disaster risk reduction agencies are in the UN system where they're constrained by the inability to criticise governments. Okay? Governments are a large part of the problem, even if they claim and the UN claims that they are part of the solution. And of course, they can be both. And we want governments to be part of the solution. And we play this game by saying we are going to provide evidence which will inform your policy, and your policy will then achieve disaster risk reduction. Rubbish. The government is not interested in evidence. Governments are also emotionally responsive people who have power, and their responses to evidence is to operate in the basis that does what is best for them. Okay? So this is evidence. This is actually not me being an outside radical. This is from a branch of the World Bank. Rob Vandenberg uses this data. He's from the Global Environment Facility. He gave these in a conference at IDS a couple of months ago. I have given this title. It's the 10-100,000 cure to damage ratio for climate change. Okay, we start off here. This is the amount of money which is currently available per annum pledged to deal with adaptation to climate change and mitigation of climate change. Of that, only about 1 billion is for adaptation to climate change. Tiny amount of money. Peanuts. What is estimated by Oxfam, by the World Bank and others, is that you need an annual spend of $100 billion to deal with adaptation alone. Not mitigation, adaptation alone. So that's the most conservative estimate of what is needed to help in largely poor countries the people to adapt to the damaging effects on their livelihoods of climate change. Okay? Meanwhile, that's the cure that we need. What's the damage in this ratio? $1 trillion is spent every year. A conservative estimate, the IMF recently estimated it at $2 trillion. This is spent on public funding. This is not private sector funding. This is public funding which subsidizes the use of fossil fuels and subsidizes agriculture, which also contributes to global warming for big industry, big farming. Okay? In other words, the ratio of the damage being done by the bottom part, is a thousandfold bigger than what we need to solve the problem. This is my evidence for why governments don't care. They don't care because this is the hard and fast figures of what is actually going on. Okay? Other shocking figures. Last year, the top 200 energy companies spent this much money on exploring for new oil and gas. Compare that with what was available for adaptation to the damage done by oil and gas. It's a ratio of more than 60 to 1. Okay? These are really, really shocking figures. The world is completely upside down. This is the wealth apparently kept in secret tax havens. Oxfam has pointed out that a tiny tax on this would solve the poverty problem around the world. If you had a tiny 1% tax on this, you would enable everyone who is under the World Bank poverty threshold to go above that poverty threshold. Just a 1% tax on this private and corporate wealth. That one's a well-known figure, and so on. Meanwhile, Oxfam's global income, 640 million a year globally, all Oxfam's combined. Okay, so this is the attempts to actually solve problems are tiny compared with the money that is spent on causing the problems. Okay, and all of these could be dealt with. I don't say easily, because we're talking about power relationships. This one is also a well-known statistic, that 60% of the world's population has less than 10% of the income, and the distribution is getting worse. Looking at causation is dangerous. Okay? And when people start to look at causation, like the Occupy movement or the 1% movement, it's dangerous. You get locked up, you have your emails monitored, you have, in Britain, you have police spies come and infiltrate your group to spy on you, doing legal, non-violent work. I won't have time to talk about it, but I put resilience there as well. I'm extremely worried about the takeover of the word resilience, because I think it is a way of avoiding talking about causation. Resilience is nice and fluffy. We all need resilience. Who could possibly be against resilience? Vulnerability, you have to say, what is causing vulnerability? What are the factors that make people vulnerable? Resilience escapes the responsibility for understanding what is causing people's potential damage. We can come back to that in questions if you want. Myth four, and this is the bulk of what we're interested in this conference, people are rational and act on the basis of information, knowledge, and evidence. They don't. And that applies to governments, international agencies, all levels. And this is Thea's point yesterday about the need to look at the culture of agencies and institutions is really quite important as well, because that's highly relevant to what we want to do. Fabien was at the conference last time. He can't be here at this one. He did his PhD in Bolivia, and I'm using some of his photos just to make a simple point about this process. This is a panorama of the city. You have this bowl shape with people living on slopes. That's clever, isn't it? Took me ages to work that out. She wants to see that again. It's really good, isn't it? It's quite impressive. So this is what you've got. Now, this goes back to the point, these are not poor people living on these slopes. You can see there's a big investment in these houses. They're not slums. They've got reinforced concrete, they've got bricks, and they're living in this inherently dangerous place. Risk of landslide and earthquake, and they live like that. I can see some mouths dropping open, which is the correct response. And yet, when Fabien got there, he thought these people were completely crazy. But after he'd finished his PhD and he went and talked to these people, he shows this photo, and he puts a ring around all the families that he's interviewed, and they have all constructed a rational story which enables them to live with the danger so that they don't actually think they're living with danger. That's their psychological and cultural adaptation to the risk. They don't think they're living with danger. Okay? And it is quite, and of course they are, because they do fall down. And when it falls down, if you can, you just put it back up with some more sticks, a bit more concrete propped under the edge of it, so you can live there for a few more years. So these people are living there voluntarily. They have not been put there by some evil rent structure or oppression, which means that this is an innocent disaster. It is not caused by anyone making them suffer in that way. The funerals and the wedding. People appear to outsiders to be irrational, but they have their own rationalities, the stories that they tell themselves. In Ghana, you may well want to, and you wouldn't be poor to do this, buy one of these coffins for your funeral. These are coffins. Aren't they wonderful? The elaborate ingenuity that's gone. This is actually, you can see in the background, there is furniture. This is a department store. You can go and buy your coffin in the department store. There's specialists who make them. If you never had one in life, you can have one in death. And people spend thousands and thousands of dollars on their funeral. And they have a funeral which is a party. And they go out with a bang. And the article, this one in The Guardian, if you go to this one, the people involved in it will tell you that it's quite ironic because we spend all this money after he's dead, but we didn't pay for a doctor when he was still alive. So people will spend money after death because of the rationality of the social capital that you buy through holding this funeral. The social capital is more important than the person surviving, in a sense. So you have this extraordinary apparent irrationality which has its own perfect internal logic of rationality. Now, I mentioned weddings. I haven't got a slide for that. But the weddings I was going to mention, the average cost of a wedding now in Britain is £20,000, around $30,000. And this is paid by poor people very often as well as rich people. And that is, again, about building social capital and giving your daughter a good send-off. And so there are all of these things that go on around emotions and cultures which are people's priorities which do not appear to outsiders to be rational. And I think it doesn't take much imagination to slide over from this into the area of disasters or climate change to see that we are expecting people to behave in a way which is not reasonable to have that expectation. So we're divorced from reality. There's a significant gap between what DRR aims at and the willingness and ability of people to respond in relation to what we want them. People do not behave in the way that disaster managers expect them to behave or want them to behave. We've got a clash of cultures, if you like. We've got a clash in which we are wanting people to do things which is unreasonable, completely unreasonable to expect them to do in the way that we want them to do it. And the disaster managers, therefore, are not behaving rationally. They think they're rational. All of these agencies think they're being perfectly rational in dealing with these disaster risks, but we are not. We are irrational. So we need to understand a whole range of things, and I'm going to have to go through these very quickly. So this is, if you like, a taster of the kinds of things that we're missing, which I think we have to take into account. Perceptions and attitudes to risk, which differ from ours, giving priority to livelihoods and people's own priorities for their livelihoods, which they will give preference to over the risks. The psychology of risk and behavioural economics can offer us quite a lot of insights into this, understanding culture in relation to risk, and dealing with the problem of dealing with unknown risks and inadequate capacities in vulnerability and culture, which is particularly important for climate change. I'm not going to have time, but I could take each one of my five components of vulnerability and look at the way in which behavioural patterns and culture affects people's willingness or ability to be protected in these different ways. So there are culture has effects on, for example, at the household level, will you engage in self-protection? People don't because of cultures of their attitude to risk. And I'm going to skip through this and just suggest that, that this is the area that where we need to be looking at much more. One framework which I think is like Russian dolls, if you like, is to see individual characteristics which can be genetic, behavioural, environmental and epigenetic. The debate now as to whether we are formed by genes or by environment is now really over because it is now known from biology and neuroscience, that actually the environment affects the way our genes behave. And this is a fundamental advance in our understanding of, and it will come back to it later on in the last slides, about inequalities of wealth, which is quite an interesting reflection on behaviours. But anyway, this is where we need to start. What is it about people's behaviour which can be understood in terms of their characteristics, their emotions, their affect by their environment, but by that I mean their social environment, not the natural environment. And extremely important seems to be peer groups. People's reference in their daily lives is their peer group, which means that people will not change their behaviour if it puts them at odds with their peer group. And that even applies to people adopting a disaster mitigation measure in their household. People will not do that if it makes them look weird compared to their neighbours. And this has been empirically shown. People in the United States will not drop their belief in creationism because it would cut them off from their entire peer group. The issue of how you engage in the idea of creationism is around the idea that if you don't believe in creationism, it isn't because you're going against the science, it is because you would be going against your entire community where you live and live your daily life with other people who share that belief. Then there is the shared culture, which is not static, as we heard yesterday, but it occurs in a wider political economic context. And then we have the power systems, the power relationships around that. Now, I think this is a potentially useful framework in which we can distinguish between processes and factors that affect the individual level, but where they are embedded within these different layers of things. And we need the different disciplines to understand these different layers and the different relationships. And I think those have been ignored in DRR, although they have been looked at in health. And I think we should be looking at health work, public health in particular, and preventive medicine, especially as an insight into what we have missed in DRR. I'm going to skip through this one as well. Within culture, I think we need to be looking at a whole range of these factors. Peer behaviour, game theory is perhaps quite interesting in this. Access to social capital is a huge thing, like the funerals and the weddings, which determines people's behaviour. Honour affects it. People, we talked yesterday about women suffering in cyclones and floods in Bangladesh, and this is related to the problem, the issue of honour. Females will not evacuate because it will bring dishonour on the family if they leave without permission, leave the house for safety without permission. Honour is a primary driver in many cultures of how people behave in the context of risk. Esteem, the Maslow hierarchy, I think is potentially quite useful. Maslow puts esteem fairly high up. I think it's actually a basic human need. And this is a fundamental thing that we need to be taking into account. Why have I put it there in the word lipstick? When Belson was relieved at the end of the Second World War, the Red Cross was there, amongst other agencies, and the army, of course, as part of the relief process. And an extraordinary thing happened in that a box arrived which contained lipsticks. Some of you may know this story. And you have these people who have been deprived of food for months. They're skeletal. You know, they're starving, hungry, and yet the women fell on this lipstick, and you have naked women, ribs showing, bones showing, who are putting on lipstick. And the interpretation that has come for this is that it gave them a way of being completely different from their identity, their self-identity, their esteem was raised by this one act of defiance of being able to wear lipstick in this context of likely to die still from malnutrition. And this extraordinary story is illustrative of how our behaviour does not conform to what you might expect. Because our expectation would be, who on earth sent lipstick? What is that about? Okay. Ontological security, which is a jargon word for being able to maintain a mental state which is balanced, and this seems to be a very powerful thing. I'll come back to that very quickly. And we need to understand culture as both a negative and a positive way, and all of these are interrelated. So we need these conceptual approaches, and I haven't got time to talk about them. What I'm, if you like, giving you is a list of the things which are missing in DRR, which we now have to go and look at and bring them in to the process. At the bottom one there, inequality as a key driver of behaviour, links up with the issue of emotions and responses, because their work on inequality shows that there is a causal behavioural linkage between high levels of inequality and what is normally labelled bad or unwanted social behaviour. In other words, inequality is a driver for people's behaviour. It may be linked to their emotional responses, to how they perceive themselves, esteem. I'm coming back to the importance of esteem in that their esteem is damaged by the way they live in their society, and that we need to understand how these all interconnect. And it's not my last slide, but I'll stop there because I've gone way over time. It's a useful stopping place because these are the things that I think we've got to take really seriously. Otherwise, it's going to get even worse as climate change makes disasters worse. Thank you very much.